I think that all of us have these very deep feelings of tenderness.
You get stronger as you become more open.
If I can be vulnerable, that'll help other people be vulnerable.
And it doesn't work for me to be silent.
I can't believe I'm going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you this story.
This is the first time that I've told aloud.
If I could have known that you and I were alike, I would have had so much more hope.
Listening to other people's stories, you realize,
wow, these people are all experiencing the same thing that we are.
You are not the only one.
Welcome to Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on Anxiety. At the end of this show, please go back to our website to answer a few questions that will help reinforce some of the important clinical takeaways. Your feedback will also help us learn more about the value of hearing our patients as teachers about what these illnesses are really like. Anxiety disorders are extremely common and as a group represent the most prevalent type of mental illness in the United States. In fact, 31.1% of adults in the U.S. experience an anxiety disorder at some point in their lives. We all know someone who suffers from anxiety, or perhaps we've experienced it ourselves at one time. In this show, we'll hear from three guests about different forms of anxiety and the challenges of treatment. Our first interview is with Monica Graben, a musician and educator. She shares her experiences with obsessive-compulsive disorder, performance anxiety, and skin picking. Here's my conversation with Monica.
I want to start at the beginning. How did anxiety first make its appearance in your life?
It wasn't until I was in my 40s that anxiety became an issue in my life. And it really came about from performance, although for all I know, it was there all along. It was just something I lived with, you know, but...
So you became aware of it. Were you performing more in your 40s?
Yes.
I see. So in your 40s, you start performing a lot. And how does the anxiety show up? In what way?
As insomnia. I had a teacher training, a professional development day I was going to do in Meriden, Connecticut, which is between 3 and 3.5 hours from where I live. And it was something I had done before, but this one was going to be particularly challenging for me in that it was high school, which I didn't work with high school teachers very much. And somehow I had to have a whole day's worth, starting 7:30 in the morning, going until 3 in the afternoon, of activities and whatever to keep them working all day. So I drove down late afternoon, and I tried to go to sleep that night, knowing I had a big day the next day. And I just watched the hours go by. And I think back then I used to take Benadryl or things like that to help me to sleep. And I didn't have any. And I just watched 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And finally, probably about 4 or 5 in the morning, I got a little bit of sleep. And then I had to go do this full day. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when the day was over, I had to then drive 3 hours home again. And I did it. But I learned later through therapy, really, that what I had set in motion that day was this idea that I had a really big responsibility and I couldn't sleep.
Right. So you're so anxious because you're thinking, I have all this really important thing I have to do. And oh, my God, I can't sleep. So there's this panic about not sleeping.
Exactly.
So presumably there's at least two layers there. So you're not sleeping because you're anxious, and then you're so anxious about the fact that you're not sleeping.
Exactly. And I have to be on my game tomorrow. I can't just phone it in. And over the years, what happened was the big gig that I couldn't sleep before became medium things. Then it became almost every time I ever had to perform, then it became the dippiest little thing that I had to do. Everything became something that I could not sleep before. And in fact, it got so that all I had to do was have the thought, what if I can't sleep? And that was basically the end of that.
So would it make you not even want, I mean, did it make you start not wanting to sign up for gigs because the insomnia ahead of time would be so awful?
Well, it got there. But it was gradual. The absolute worst point for me ended up being a residency that I had at a middle school in Turner, Maine, which is about an hour and a half from my home. And I would have to get there very early in the morning, maybe 8-ish, and be ready to roll around 8 o'clock in the morning. And at this point now, my doctor had prescribed sleeping pills. So I did have sleeping pills, which got stronger as the time went on. And so at this point, I'm now taking Dalmane, which is a very heavy-duty sleeping pill of the old school, I think. And I would take one right before, you know, at a normal hour, maybe before bed, and then at midnight or so, knowing that it's going to make me really wretched the next day, I would just be so desperate, I would take another one and watch the hours again go by. And this was day after day, to the point where I was getting an hour to an hour and a half of sleep, literally, and then driving an hour or more, and then working all day with kids and having to really be on my game, drive home, take care of my family, you know, do all that, and then do it again. And that was when I just, I can't live like this anymore. So I went to my doctor, my family practitioner, who I've known for years and years, and he heard this story and said, you know, I think you've got OCD, and I think I really might be able to help you. And he prescribed Paxil for me, 20 milligrams. And he also sent me to a therapist. And that just changed my life.
How did it change your life?
Suddenly, I could go to sleep at night. And
suddenly, so literally, it was a quick change?
It was within, it takes a couple of weeks for the drug to get into your system. And then I just found that things that had bothered me so much that I would just obsess about, they just weren't doing the same thing to me. I don't know how to explain it other than the other thing he did was he gave me permission. You know, taking the sleeping pill is not the end of the world. This is not a failing or anything like that. When you have particular stress, if you have a gig coming up, go ahead and do that. It's okay. So that's what I would allow myself to do that. I would only need one pill. And he started me on temazepam, which is a less obtrusive drug for me. I don't even feel it the next day. I could take one pill, and if I wasn't performing, I didn't take anything, and it was fine. I could manage all that.
Right, so you get into therapy for the sleep. Your sleep is improving dramatically. You're no longer, because you can sleep, you're no longer obsessing as much before your performances. So there's enormous relief about that. When does the skin picking start to become more of a problem?
Shortly thereafter. So I had always had obsessive compulsive tendencies. Actually, I was going to mention, when I was a child, ever since I've been a little girl, I count syllables, I count things, I can't help myself, I'm constantly counting things. I just have these little rituals that I do, and that's...
Right, and that would be considered the compulsion part.
Exactly, the compulsion part, right.
Yeah.
So I do have trouble where my skin gets very itchy and I will scratch and then I will make these scabs. But after taking the Paxil, which I did not associate with it at all at first, I just noticed all of a sudden I've got all these things and I keep scratching and I keep picking. And I went to another doctor who for something totally different, and he saw my back and he said, oh, I think you should see a dermatologist. And I said, okay, that's a good idea. So I made an appointment with the dermatologist, and he took one look at my back. I mean, literally within an instant, he said, oh, that's stress. And I said, wait a minute, I'm on Paxil. I don't have stress.
Right.
What are you talking about?
I'm sleeping. How could I have stress?
I don't have stress. So that was when I discovered that anxiety can be a little like whack-a-mole. You press it down on one spot, but it can rise somewhere else. So now I'm on this seesaw. Okay, I really sleep a lot better, but I find myself picking my skin, which is really embarrassing. It makes scars that everyone can see. And That was another thing. Another therapist, when I went to see him about skin picking, said, what do you think people see? And of course, I think people see these scars everywhere. And he looked at me and he said, you really think that's what people see when they meet you? And I was, of course.
And was his kind of incredulity, was that a little more helpful?
Because, I mean, much.
Yes.
I've thought of that so many times.
Yes. Because he was really kind of being a reality check. Like, actually,
totally.
It hasn't even...
No one else sees this. And that's what I would say to anyone who has this problem. No one sees it the way you see it. No one. Nobody cares.
Well, because so initially, my assumption before I met my first patient with skin picking was that the embarrassing thing was that there was a compulsion that felt out of control.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't know was that the actual visual signs of it were the embarrassing thing. And for you, is it
both?
Absolutely
both. I mean, you're so embarrassed that you cannot stop from doing this thing that is obviously detrimental. And you can be very good. You can have, four or five good days in a row where you are really disciplined. And one afternoon, 1 hour, can completely destroy that, and you're right back where you started. It's not, you have all these scars once again.
And so take me through it, because so there you are, and you've got some kind of little scab on your arm to start with, say. Maybe you had a mosquito bite or something that wasn't initially self-inflicted.
Right.
Is the picking driven by the wish to kind of make your skin perfectly smooth?
Yes.
Aha. Uh-huh. For your own sake, or because it feels better, or because it would look better in your mind?
No. No, it's for your own sake. It's just to feel better.
Okay. And then the feeling itself when you do start picking, is it... What is it like?
That is... It feels good. And... that's the problem, is the pain almost feels good. And that is awful, but it's true. It's relaxing. I hate to say it, but it is. I guess people who cut themselves, it's probably got some sort of relaxing sense too. I don't know, but it's... you find yourself checking yourself a lot. There's a lot of just touching. And it kind of catches you both ways. It can be from lack of stimulation or too much stimulation.
And it's something you can do pretty mindlessly, it sounds like.
Totally mindlessly. And you can catch yourself doing this and say, oh my God, here I am again. And it's very, very frustrating.
Now, you made an analogy to cutting yourself, and cutting, has many different meanings for different people. It doesn't have one standard thing. But for some people, there is a relief in kind of transforming overwhelming emotional distress into physical pain. That's much easier to bear. Does it have that sense for you?
I don't know.
I'm not hearing that.
No.
I mean, I'm not hearing
I don't
you do it
so.
Out of desperation.
No.
So that part of it is really quite different.
Then maybe we won't use that.
Maybe not.
We won't use that analogy.
Although, I mean, the thing that it seems is similar is that you can actually inflict actual real harm on yourself.
Yes.
Make yourself bleed and have a scar afterwards.
Yes.
And feel somewhat mortified afterward.
Yes.
That people see it.
Yes.
Or the fears that they might see it.
Exactly. Well, they do. It's not that no one ever sees it. They do. Nobody cares that they see it. They don't see it the way you do.
Yeah.
Can I tell you a brief little vignette that just happened to me like that?
Please.
Because of skin picking, and I and by the way, I am absolutely mortified to even say that I have this problem, but we'll go from there. Because of that, I tended for many years to really shy away from anything sleeveless. That was a big thing for me. And over the years, I really have come more to grips with the fact that I can live with this, that it's actually worth it to me to be able to sleep if dealing with one section of my anxiety causes another to pop up.
Right.
I can actually live with that, but it has taken quite a long time for me to say that. But just last week or two, I did a show, and I was wearing a sleeveless blouse that I intended to wear a jacket over, but I was setting up So I was just in my sleeveless blouse. And I'm just doing my work, and I saw a friend, and I went over to see my friend, and she said, "Monica, your arms look so great." And what she meant was they looked fit, I looked really healthy. And to me, it was hysterically funny, because here's this thing I'm always trying to hide, and nobody sees this.
In fact, all she sees is how strong
you look. You look strong. Exactly. One therapist said, I told her how, I just see everybody else's skin, and I never see anybody that looks like me. And she said, "That's because that's what you look for. When you look at a person, you look at their skin. Do you think other people immediately look at your skin? That's not what they're looking at."
Particularly like the skin on your arms?
Yeah, right? They don't care. Not. That's not, they have their own thing they're looking for. Right. So I really have learned that although I do have this problem and it drives me crazy less than it used to, mainly because of help I've gotten through therapy, through meditation, through just calming down, that it really is not the end of the world.
Part of what I love about that is, often the question is sort of, what does recovery look like? Does it look like I've stopped picking my skin, or does it look like I've made my peace with it?
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hearing from you is that it's really the second. You may still pick at your skin sometimes, but you've made your peace with it. You're not as ashamed as you used to be.
Mm-mm.
And it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's not okay, but again, everybody's got something, I mean, I'm not perfect. And that's right. The other piece, obsessive compulsive disorder has a big element of perfectionism in it. I have to be perfect, I have to do it the best, and I have to be the best prepared, and this, that. And this has really made me face up to the fact that I am not perfect. I have this major flaw, and it's out there for everybody to see, and me to see, and me to feel responsible for. And yet, that's life, that's how it is.
This may seem too Pollyanna-ish, but do you ever think, well, maybe it's actually a gift because it helps me befriend myself?
No, it's too Pollyanna-ish.
I thought that was a stretch.
Yeah, it's a stretch.
So when I was first thinking about this interview, I was thinking of framing it in terms of you having three different kinds of anxiety. Performance anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, and skin picking. And really, the more we talk, what I'm getting clearer about is that it's all different ways of OCD. I mean, that the sleeplessness was a kind of obsessive worry. The skin picking was a kind of checking. So one of the cardinal symptoms of OCD is needing to check things like, have I turned the stove off? Have I locked the door? And what you're describing is checking your skin. Is there
right.
any bump?
I have actually never thought of it that way. That's very interesting. Yeah.
Does it make sense to you?
Yes, it absolutely makes sense.
Yes. And so actually, they're all really different ways that obsessive compulsive
yes.
sort of expresses itself. And I want to ask now about a third way, because I understand from you, and this is very common in OCD, but often very hard to talk about, is that also this kind of recurrent violent images or
yes.
thoughts can come into your mind that are completely foreign to who you are, anything you'd ever want to do, but nonetheless
yes.
you have these recurring
yes.
violent images. And tell me a little bit about that for you.
I would work in the kitchen, I love to cook, and I would be in the kitchen and I would pick up a knife, and it seemed like every time I picked up a knife, I had this fear that I would stab my children with it, that I would stab somebody with it. And
stab a person that you loved.
Someone I loved, absolutely. And the interesting thing about that was I had compassion on myself right away for that. I knew that this was just a thought. I knew that it wasn't real. I don't know why. And I do remember thinking about, what about some poor young mother who might have a thought like this? Oh my God, what a horrible thing to have to live with. And I'm so, I was so relieved that I didn't. And that's actually one of my main reasons for talking to you today, is that I know how disturbing that can feel, and you feel like you must be really mentally ill. You know, serious. This is serious. And it was not me. And that is the one, the other thing that I have to say, the Paxil just ended. It was gone. Obsessive thoughts like that disappeared. That was miraculous to me.
Part of what's so touching to me about your story is that, so you have this horrifying thought of stabbing one of your children, which, I mean, basically there's really no other more horrifying thought that I can think of. And yet you are able to have compassion for yourself and realize this does not mean something bad about me. This does not mean I actually secretly hate my children or don't want to be a mother. You were able to really have confidence that it didn't mean that about you. I'm so glad for you, because I think that often, you know, postpartum depression is very well described and it's in the popular culture, but postpartum obsessive thinking, in particular this kind of anxiety, is very common, but much less named and much less understood. I actually remember when I was a young mother, I was in a swimming pool with my child, kind of bouncing him around, and I had this fleeting, terrifying thought that I could, you know, bounce him under the water, and in a matter of a minute or two, he would actually die. And even though it happened to me once throughout that whole period of his life, it disturbed me greatly, because I don't think I maybe had as much compassion for myself as you did. And it made me terrified about, was I a bad mother? What did this secretly mean about me? And
it's very easy to think that.
Yes.
It's very easy to think that.
And it's only since, in some ways, being a psychiatrist was quite helpful to me, because I started seeing it a lot and realizing that actually the people who are the safest, you know, to never hurt their children, are the ones who have these kinds of obsessive thoughts. In fact, the distress it causes is a very reassuring sign.
Right.
And
right.
I began to think of it that maybe sort of one of the cruelties of obsessive compulsive disorder is that it takes something that you would fear the most in the world and takes that and sort of turns it into this haunting worry. And it's actually maybe a sign of how much you care about something.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what I try to offer.
Well, the other thing that was really empowering for me at that time, this was when I had first been diagnosed with OCD, and but I was still having these thoughts occasionally. I read a book about OCD, and there were a number of stories. And I remember one was a young father who had OCD, and he had exactly the same thoughts, right? You know, the knives. And I thought, holy moly. I was so mind blown to find out that this thing that to me was completely horrifying, it was just truly a symptom. It's like having a fever when you're sick, you know, it didn't mean anything.
At the end of this interview, Monica acknowledges the relief that comes from learning her thoughts are a symptom of a brain disease. Studies have repeatedly shown differences in brain structure and function in individuals with OCD. Treatment with medication or therapy leads to reduction of activity in a brain region called the thalamus, which is likely what leads to reduction in symptoms. These brain changes can be seen on PET scans after only 4 weeks of intensive cognitive behavioral therapy, demonstrating the power of psychotherapy to change the neural circuitry of OCD. We turn now to the challenges of parenting a child with anxiety. Valerie shares her daughter Cassandra's story of severe social anxiety. Social anxiety is the second most commonly diagnosed type of anxiety disorder after specific phobia. Symptoms typically begin around age 13, and if left untreated, can be associated with problems with school, jobs, relationships, and even substance abuse. The prognosis when treated is very positive, making this an important disorder for both pediatric and adult providers to diagnose and treat. For Cassandra, Valerie discusses what things work to help manage her social anxiety and what things may actually have made things worse.
Welcome to Safe Space, Valerie.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
So I understand that you were able to adopt Cassandra when she was about 4.5 months old. Is that right?
That's right.
So you come back to the States with this baby that you'd waited for a long time, I'm imagining. Do you feel like she was anxious from the beginning, or is it something that developed later?
Anxious wouldn't have been a word that I would have used to describe her at that time. I spent a lot of time alone with her. So it was hard to see any anxiety. She was very bonded with me immediately. And we were in love. You know, it was a love affair, the two of us. Where I started to see something shifting was when she would be in the presence of other children and be expected to perform in some way. She would just completely shut down again. And I could feel this feeling like, come on, Cassandra, can't you be like the other kids? And that energy would get picked up by her, I'm sure. And it felt like there was something wrong with her. And today when I say that word, I really hate using that word because it's been very shaming.
Right, but at the time you noticed a difference. She seemed different than the other kids.
Yes. I also knew she was really smart. She started talking really young, very early. Her language, she was incredibly articulate. So I was confused. I was like, huh? But, you know, somehow if the smart part of her could take over, then she would be able to be like the other kids. I mean, it wasn't logical at all, but...
Right, but this is such a common theme in this series, but with anxiety in general, is the kind of disconnect between the mind, the intellectual understanding, and the anxiety, that they have really seemingly no relationship to each other, that you can't kind of talk yourself down rationally.
Exactly.
Which is so humbling, so humbling.
Yeah,
so, and plus she seemed, I mean, with the development of language, I'm imagining with a child, one thinks of that as a social ability.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can imagine that you were thinking, "What, you're so verbal, why can't you connect with other kids more easily?"
Yeah. And, you know, I would try to organize play. I'll never forget one of her birthday parties. I think she was like 5 or 6, something like that. And so the kids come over, and at that age, the mothers are still sticking around. She freaked out after about 5 minutes. She's like, "I want them to all go home now, Mom." But not loud, just to me in the kitchen. She pulled me in the kitchen. She's crying and crying. And I had a part that was angry at her. Like, why can't you? There's only 5 kids. They're all your friends. And she actually went up to her room and shut the door. And the party went on. She didn't even come down for her birthday cake. And she stayed up in her room for probably another hour. And then the parents realized she wasn't coming down, and they left. I never had another birthday party for her again after that. I realized it was not... She was miserable.
Right, so I can imagine so many different feelings. I mean, compassion for your daughter, but perhaps embarrassment and anger or frustration overlaying that. I mean, what?
Yeah, and I couldn't understand, and these were her friends. I didn't understand what was so scary about having them there.
Right, I mean, at this point, what were your working hypotheses? I mean, what were you imagining might be the case?
I thought she was just very shy. And that we could overcome the shyness with exposure. You know, let's just keep trying. Let's keep doing this. But it wasn't working.
Right.
And so also, as you can imagine, being a psychotherapist, there was more shame there because it was like, I'm supposed to know how to deal with this.
Right.
And I don't know what the heck I'm doing. Right.
Right. It's like, oh, my gosh, I'm failing at this, even with my own child.
Yeah. And if, you know... Here I am trying to help other people, and I can't parent my own daughter.
Right. So it brings up, like, all this fraud feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And did it make you want to hide it? Like, did it make you more hesitant?
For years I wanted to hide it. And what would happen is we would go out less and less socially because she's very good at covering up when she's feeling anxious. In fact, she said to me the other day, to have anybody know that I'm feeling out of control in my body is absolutely terrifying. So she's really, really good at covering it up, but I, as her mother, started to learn. I could tell the signs. I could see when her body would tighten. I knew. I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew something was wrong. To this day, she's 22. She still lives at home with us, and there are times when I will say to myself, okay, Valerie, what are you doing wrong? You're doing something wrong. You know, the cognitive behavioral approach is exposure, exposure, exposure. You got to kick her out. You got to push her into the world. And I have learned by lots of bad experiences with her where I made a lot of mistakes that's not the right thing to do.
It's such an interesting dilemma because one of the themes that's been emerging in this series is when... And until now, I've only been talking to the person who suffers directly with the anxiety. And what the people have been telling me is that the temptation to avoid the fearful experience is so enormous, but that actually, you know, it tends to make it worse. And that what they've each had to do in their own therapy is to kind of go and face the dragon, as it were, go do the thing that's the hardest to do. And that they then get some sense of mastery. But as a parent, it's very different if you choose that and force your kid to do it. It's totally different than if your child is choosing to face her own dragon. Because I'm imagining if you're forcing her to go face some feared experience, it actually only makes her feel helpless and almost sort of abandoned by the person she's, would trust to help her. So it doesn't have the same redemptive... Yeah, tell me, and like when you say there's an example like of a time that you did try to expose her to something and that backfired, what would be an example of that?
That's a good question. Okay, so 2 or 3 years ago, both my husband and I wanted her to have more experiences in the outside world. I said, you really need to start working. You're 19, and you need to have some experience. I will help you in whatever way I can. And she would just shut down. And so finally I said, look, there's a movie theater down the street. They're taking high school students. You're a perfect person to work there. You can sell tickets. More shut down. Finally she said, okay, all right. We've downloaded the application. We drove literally an eighth of a mile into the center. And I mean, I could start crying right now just thinking about it. She's sitting next to me in the car. And she's filled out the application perfectly. She's an unbelievable perfectionist. Her handwriting looks like a typewriter. And she can't get out of the car. And I'm saying, honey, I'll bring it in for you. And she can't even talk to me. She can't even look at me. And in moments like that, Anne, I feel like this is all wrong. This is so wrong. I can't do this to her. So I said, we're not doing this. I turned around. Of course, my angry part shows up because I'm feeling so... I mean, I was crying, actually, in the car with her. But then I start feeling angry because I need to pull myself together and put one foot in front of the other. And I come home and I say to Louie, this is impossible. She's never going to be able to be in life and in the world. And then we went to her therapist, and her therapist helped us. And little by little, she's now working for... a lawyer, she's a paralegal, a friend of mine, and my friend says she's the best paralegal she's ever had. She's never had anyone so attentive to detail, and she just wishes that Cassandra wanted to be a lawyer.
So in that moment from the movie theater, you pull back, but then what shifted that she was able to get the job with your friend?
Good question. What happened was she felt safe enough to say to me, with the help of her therapist, Mom, you have no idea how much I want to get a job. You have no idea how much I want to be able to be out in the world, but I need your help. And forcing me to fill out an application to go to do a job where I have to talk to people, and I have to look them in the eye, and lots of people come in who I don't know, I can't do that. So we brainstormed together about, well, what could you do? She could be in an office, one-on-one with another person, doing research on the computer. So how could I help her? And then, fortuitously, my friend said, is one of your daughters interested in working with me? And I didn't think of Cassandra. I thought of my younger daughter. I said, oh, yeah, sure, my younger daughter. Cassandra said, well, what about me? So that's how it started.
And how long has she been working for her?
2 years.
That's so great. And does being able to do that, do you feel like that's fed her confidence?
Absolutely. First of all, she loves making money and she gets paid really well, so that helps.
That always helps, yes.
And she's got a cottage industry. The other thing I wanted to tell you is she works on the computer. She does a lot of gaming on the computer. Almost all of her social life is through gaming. And she's got a cottage industry on the internet where she sells nail polish, and she makes quite a bit of money doing that. So she's quite industrious.
She's resourceful. Well, I want to ask you more about the computer because...
Yeah.
So the whole social world of the computer, does that trigger her anxiety as well, or is that different?
Yes. In fact, that's been a huge source of difficulty for us with her. And I have really come around to appreciating what the computer does for her, but boy, I had parts that were so freaked out about it. So, of course, when I saw that she was pulling further and further away from her, you know, real-time friends, I got really anxious. And she would go to school and feel really like a freak, and then she'd come home and she'd go online, and all of her friends that would play the game with her would say, would welcome her and say hi, and there was a huge community of friends, not so much anymore because she's more connected to her boyfriend, but that it will be eventually where she finds more friends again, I think, is online.
So that was like a safe haven for her.
Exactly. And we were threatening constantly, you know, when she wouldn't come down to dinner, or she wouldn't come out of her room, or wouldn't go for a walk or a bicycle ride. You know, we're avid outdoor people. She hates being outdoors. She's just terrified of being around people. So she would, you know, my husband would threaten to disconnect the internet, and we had no idea what we were doing. She had a whole world in there that we were threatening to take away from her. So my husband and I would get really polarized about it, and we were, you know, he'd say, we've made the biggest mistake, we should never have bought her that laptop, blah, blah, blah. And he would literally go down the basement, disconnect the internet. And then he'd say, okay, 5 hours, you're not going to be without it. And I'd be saying, don't do that, she's going to freak out. And anyway, long story short, he finally said, okay, that's it, disconnecting the whole house from the internet. And she was in eighth grade, and she was, for a day, she was crying off and on, inconsolable. And she finally said, you've taken my best friend away from me. And I thought she was talking about the computer, which made me even more scared.
Yes.
And it finally came out that she had a best friend who lived in Maryland, another Chinese girl who played this game with her, and they had been talking through the game for a year. And my heart just, like, first, there were two things that happened. One, I thought, oh, my God, what if this is some kind of child predator? That was the first fear that I had. And then the other place that I swung to was, God, what a horrible mother. She has a best friend, and I just cut her off completely. So it took a while, a lot of fights between my husband and myself to talk this through. And finally, Cassandra gave me her friend's name and her parents' phone number. She'd never talked to her. It was all through the computer. And I called this young woman's mother, and her mother didn't know either, and we talked on the phone. She was Chinese, and she invited us to come down and visit, which was, again, huge for me to do. But I said, I got to do this. I got to meet these people. I want to know that they're real. And we did. We went down to an anime festival, and it was really fun. They were a wonderful family. She was a wonderful girl, and Cassandra felt very held by that.
Wonderful. It seems like such a story, not only of, you know, a different way of interacting socially because of anxiety, but also just a huge generational story that,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
You're so, yes, thinking about predators and addiction and reading this as such a dangerous experience, when for her it sounds like it was really a godsend.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to say about her, she's got this, between figuring out what the diagnosis was for her, this perfectionism was the piece that started to show up in middle school. And so, you know, worrying about if she didn't do it perfectly, that she was going to be judged. So she was worried about her friend not liking her when she saw her. You know, her nose was too big, or or whatever. You know, you name it. It wasn't going to be quite right.
Well, it makes sense that perfectionism and social anxiety kind of dovetail, because social anxiety,
yeah,
is this sort of excruciating self-consciousness and a fear of being negatively judged by others.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
those two are just mutually reinforcing. So a couple other questions I want to ask you before we have to stop. One is, so you're a psychotherapist. You're an extremely resourceful person. You're clearly a very invested mother. What are some of the things that you tried to do to help Cassandra that ultimately really did not help her?
Well, lots of things. The first one was that she had sensory integration therapy, and that really helped her focus a bit more, and, you know, moving the right and left sides of her body really helped her feel a bit less anxious. That was when she was about 7 or 8. And then she...
And so let me just pause. So that's a therapy that's really involved in working through the body to help.
Yes. Yeah. And she has a lot of issues around food and certain textures that bother her. Being touched bothers her. And so they diagnosed her with a sensory issue. So that did help. That was about 3 or 4 months long. That helped some. It also helped us understand what to do and what not to do. And then she was diagnosed with depression. She took, we tried antidepressants. She doesn't like taking medication at all. She's very clear about that. But she did try. I have to give her that. And when she was diagnosed with ADD, she also was given some stimulants, which she didn't like taking. And subsequently, when she let me just pause
for a second, because I think clinically it's often confusing to distinguish ADD, attention deficit disorder, from anxiety, because anxiety is such a preoccupation, and people are so distracted by their fear and their dread and their terror that it's very hard to be present and focus. And often kids are misdiagnosed with ADD when in fact it's anxiety. And of course, Ritalin makes anxiety worse.
Right.
So it sounds like that's what happened to you guys.
Exactly. The second time, it was more thorough, the testing, and they said they didn't think she had ADD. They thought it was an anxiety disorder, which, on the one hand, was a relief, but then I thought, well, now there's no medication, because she really doesn't want to take anxiety medication. That makes her feel more out of control to take medication, so...
Yes, because you're spacey. Yes, it does, because you feel spacey and a little out of it, and that's scary.
Well, it's more... No, it's not that. It's more she wants to know what's happening in her body, and she wants to be organic. She doesn't want chemicals in her body.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
My experience clinically is that when I'm prescribing for someone, the people that it's hardest to prescribe for are the people with severe anxiety because they're so afraid of the pill. And
exactly.
The trust it takes to actually ingest something that's going to affect your mind...
Mm-hmm.
So powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so sensory integration therapy helped a little. Misdiagnosis didn't help. Medication was not very helpful. What else?
let's see, what else? We went through probably 5 or 6 therapists. And then she did do a cognitive behavioral therapy.
And why don't you explain what that is?
So that's where she was slowly exposed to situations that were scary to her, that she couldn't tolerate, and it worked a little bit. So the idea is that the more she avoids something she's scared of, the more that part of her then thinks, well, if I avoid it, then I'm okay. So there's more and more in the world that she avoids.
Right.
So in the cognitive behavioral therapy that she had for 2 years with a specialist who was training and working with anxiety, she actually did help her learn how to take the bus to school, which was great. But getting any better in terms of social stuff with people, the cognitive behavioral therapy only made it worse, because her therapist would say, well, now I want you to try to be in the company of other people, maybe talk to someone at school and make friends with them. Well, that only made her feel terrible because she can't do that.
Right. So it sounds like feels like a prescription for torture.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
It sounds like any redemptive outcome in your case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or that the shame that comes out of feeling anxious, that somehow an anxious person can fix it easily. Get over it. You know, it's not that scary. That really upsets me. You know, if Cassandra could have gotten over it, believe me, she would have been the first person to do it.
It feels like it's in some ways a stance that's based in so much ignorance about how powerful anxiety really is.
Right, right. And you know what, Anne? You know, part of me feels really terrible that I didn't understand that for so many years. There was a part of me that wanted her to just get over it.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
How could you not have, part of you wanted that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And blamed myself, you know, that I was causing this.
Yeah. There's no way to be a mother without blaming yourself or something.
Yeah.
Our final guest is Rob, a licensed psychotherapist who was diagnosed with obsessive-compulsive disorder at the age of 21. Rob shares his story about living with OCD and specifically how this affected his ability to make decisions throughout his life. He describes the physical expression of anxiety in his panic attacks. Rob discusses how treatment through internal family systems, or IFS, and eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR, were both helpful at improving his symptoms of anxiety.
So we're going to talk today about obsessive-compulsive disorder, and I think it might be worth us just defining what that is to start out with, which is typically a pattern of obsessive thoughts that even if they don't make sense to the person, nonetheless, they can't get them out of their head. They're kind of like a closed loop from which there's no exit. And the only seeming exit is by a compulsion, some kind of repetitive action, often stereotyped as kind of cleaning or checking, or counting or tapping things, as a way to try to escape from the pattern of obsessions. So let me just ask you, Rob, does that description fit your experience? And if so, how?
Yes, it does. That's a good description. For me, it also includes trouble with making decisions to the point where I get paralyzed with a decision.
I see. So the obsession is the decision making itself, like back and forth,
back and forth, over and over in my head, because either choice seems like it's going to be the wrong one.
Oh. And so I know you were diagnosed at age 21, but tell me a little bit about how this first showed up in your life.
Right. Well, I did suffer with it from an early age, but no one really put a finger on it until 21. So I did go through the typical type of obsessions that kids do go through, which is like hand washing, having to do things just right, like tap things a certain number of times. I remember my mom calling me from upstairs when I was down in our crawl space where the bikes were kept, and I had to tap my bicycle X number of times before it felt just right. And if I didn't, it was just this awful feeling that something bad would happen. And so I would be kind of glued to my bike in the crawl space, tapping it. It should be like, dinner's on the table already. And that's what it was like.
This, when you describe this awful feeling something bad would happen, so it sounds like dread about something really bad happening is a huge part of the experience.
That's right. Like something would happen to me, something would happen to my bicycle, something would happen in general, but it was kind of a vague feeling of something dreaded would occur. And I think my parents were overall very patient, but there are times when they just lost it because I was so crazed with certain thoughts. And I remember specifically going to camp, maybe like age 11 or something like that, and I wanted to make sure my parents knew everything that I felt guilty about, and I kept asking them over and over, are you sure you understand what I'm saying? Did you hear me just right? And they would say, oh, Rob, nothing you've done could be so bad that you need to worry about it. And I would say, yeah, but I just need to tell you one more thing. And this went on the whole ride up to New Hampshire from Massachusetts. I just felt I had this compulsion to get these things that I felt so guilty about out so that they heard them and they could forgive me. And if I left any stone unturned, it would leave me with this debilitating anxiety that they didn't hear everything perfectly.
So it almost like the only way to feel relieved of your guilt was to make sure you'd gotten all of it out, you'd confessed all of it.
Yeah, but it seemed like it was endless.
Oh, I see. So there was no way to exit. It was just like a loop that could just keep going and going and going.
Yeah, and as we got closer to camp, I felt the anxiety increase to the point where I was just going out of my mind because I knew they were going to be leaving me off for 2 months.
I see. So you understand that now, it sounds like, that the real anxiety was about the separation and the amount of time
That's
and so
exactly
on.
That's exactly right. It was really about the separation from my parents because my parents, I was very, very close to. You know, one psychiatrist had said to me, you're almost like attached like a umbilical cord still.
Mm. Now, that was as an adult or that was when you were a child?
That
or
was when I was older.
I see. And as you know, anxiety is usually such a physical experience. When you're caught in a sort of OCD loop, when you're caught in a loop of not being able to do the thing enough to get relief, what is that like for you in your body?
Well, I feel powerless. I feel almost like I used to equate it as a kid and even as an adult, like Superman with kryptonite on his around his body.
Right. So here's this person who's normally so strong, who's like completely disabled.
Yeah.
Feels helpless.
Very helpless.
So it sounds like you felt helpless in some ways to get rid of it, but the feeling of the anxiety itself, is it like pounding heart, beating, you know, like shortness of breath? What is the actual anxiety itself like?
Yeah, my body would be tingling, and also just this terrible dread, like I can't breathe, I can't survive it. You know, even as an adult, if I fast forward, I'd be in my office debilitating anxiety. Like, I felt like I almost wanted to jump out the window. The anxiety was so bad.
Did you find, as you started to know yourself better, that you tried to hide it from people? Or did you find that there was no way to hide it, and so you had to tell people up front? Like, how did you handle the kind of disclosure about it?
Well, I remember, you know, my parents knew about it, but then they wanted to share it with my brothers, and they kind of laughed when they were told about it, and I wanted to sort of collapse and hide from it. I mean, that's when I first felt shame.
Why did they laugh?
I remember one of the things that I often did was they would touch my hair because they knew it bothered me. You know, I always felt like, oh, are their hands sticky? Are they dirty? You know, would I have to wash my hair 100 times to get it clean? And so when my mom mentioned that I had OCD, there was one of the brothers, I can't remember which one, because I have two, they sort of said, yeah, I guess that makes sense given all the trouble you've had with us touching your hair. And there was some chuckle with that, but yeah, it was kind of painful.
No, it sounds like, because it sounds like it was a torture for you inside.
Yeah.
Not really funny at all.
I was kind of relieved to be able to finally tell someone, and then it wasn't met with understanding.
Yeah. You mentioned that there were other things that helped you. I'd like to hear, what were the things that have really helped?
Well, to talk about those things, we have to be really fast forward to after I became a therapist.
Okay.
I followed a model called Internal Family Systems, developed by Dick Schwartz. And for the first time, a therapist was really patient to listen to each part of me that felt one way or another about the same topic. In previous therapies, I had a psychologist who would tell me that a thought that I had was obsessive, and I didn't feel like she really wanted to hear about why I wanted something or didn't want something. It was more like just labeling it as obsessive. And in Internal Family Systems, with the right therapist, he would really listen in detail to each side that had something to say about the same topic. You know, why I wanted to be with that girlfriend, why I didn't want to be with that girlfriend.
And how did that help, Rob?
Well, not quite sure still. I think it's that each part got their time.
That's so interesting. It sounds like when you really honored the obsession, when you didn't try to shush it or move on past it.
Yeah.
Actually, the overall anxiety lessened to the point that the obsession didn't have to be so powerful.
That's right.
Huh. So maybe your very early instinct as a child going to camp about needing to be heard was actually really right on.
Yeah, I certainly can understand how parents, a girlfriend, whoever was involved would get frustrated because I could go on and on for hours.
Right, and I certainly know. I mean, I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm having this kind of sinking feeling in my heart of knowing at times as a therapist when I've worked with someone with obsessions where I haven't been nearly as patient as I should have, and I'm feeling very remorseful. And I appreciate so much what you're saying about the importance of the therapist managing their own impatience so they can really be present. I'm resolving to do better, Rob, inspired by you.
Yeah, well, the psychologist that I've worked with for the last 3 or 4 years has been such a breath of fresh air in terms of the patience to listen to each part. That was something that I've never had before to that degree.
Mm. I want to ask you now about the overlap, because we've been talking almost exclusively about obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to hear about the overlap, because I know you suffer from kind of more general anxiety and also very specifically from panic attacks.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear, do you think of these things as related, or do you think of it as sort of like you have this real vulnerability to being anxious kind of in any number of ways, or do they feed each other?
Yeah. I think, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. The good news is that my anxiety is so much better.
Tell me more about that.
With internal family systems and another approach called EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing.
Now let's slow down. Okay, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Yeah.
Why don't you just tell me a little bit what that is for people not familiar with EMDR?
Oh, sure. It was developed in the 80s by a psychologist that realized that if you stimulate the brain bilaterally, as the person is taken back to some events in their past, that we can move the storage of that memory from one part of the brain to the other. And in that movement of those memories, they hold less impact on a person's fears, worries, emotions.
Right. So concretely, when you say stimulate the brain bilaterally, you're talking about like sounds that alternate from right ear to left ear, or moving your eyes back and forth to the right or the left, or feeling right. A buzzing in your right hand than your left hand. So there's a stimulation that comes in on either side, back and forth.
That's right.
Okay, so tell me more. How did EMDR help you with anxiety?
It helped me mostly with the panic attacks. I was having debilitating panic attacks as a therapist up until last year, or even closer. And I would be in the middle of a session, and all of a sudden my body, I would feel like I was coming out of my skin. And I would do everything in my power to contain that feeling while I'm in the presence of a client who I didn't want, of course, to know anything about what I was suffering with.
Oh, that sounds so awful, and while you're trying to pay attention and really be present with them.
Right. I mean, it's supposed to be about them, not me.
It sounds almost impossible.
It was grueling, but I did the best I could. And finally I said, I need some additional help. So I went to eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapist. And in literally 9 sessions, the total, the panic attacks were gone.
Wow. And so would you go back to a scene where you'd had panic and then experience this bilateral stimulation, and then over time it just kind of, the anxiety about it lessened?
Yeah, I would be asked to bring up that memory of when I had the panic, and I had a renewed sense of confidence. I could handle it. One of the worst panic attacks I had, and the most embarrassing one, was in front of a couple that I was counseling. And so my EMDR treatment was to go back to that scene in my mind when I was with that couple and had the panic attack in front of them and was embarrassed and humiliated.
Do you feel like now, I mean, it sounds awful.
It was.
I also wonder, now that the panic is so much less powerful for you, do you think there's ever a way, I mean, this may be completely utopian fantasy here, do you think there's ever a way that you might experience intense anxiety like that in your work and be able to kind of speak for it and model not being ashamed of it in a way that might actually help your client?
Yeah, well now, and sometimes I do self-disclosure. It's rare though with my clients, because you know, we're always taught as therapists not to get into our own stuff. But there are some clients I share who suffer with debilitating anxiety and panic attacks, what I've suffered with, because I'm not ashamed about it. And of course, it's easier to talk about it when you feel like you've overcome it. When you're in the middle of it, it's very hard to talk about it.
Right, because it's so alive, the anxiety is so
real. It's still
real,
it's happening, but if it's in the past, I can say, well, I've conquered that, and there is a way out.
That concludes this episode of Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on anxiety. Please fill out the few quick questions on the website that will give you credit for listening and help to solidify some of the most important clinical takeaways. We'd be grateful, too, for your feedback about this show. Your responses will help us measure the impact of hearing stories from the people who know these struggles from the inside. Thank you to the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation for their support of this project, our guests, our producers Gabe Graben and Caitlin Swalje, and our education coordinator, Sarah Powers. I'm Dr. Ann Hallward, and I invite you to check out the rest of our archive devoted to telling authentic and inspiring stories about the things we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more.